headlines this hour. A senior Iranian security official says that Tehran is determined to stop U.S. terrorist and counter-security acts in the region. International alarm is growing over a new variant of the coronavirus in the U.K. So far, more than 40 countries have blocked flights or travel links with Britain. Also in the headlines, U.S. Attorney General William Barr says that he has no plan to appoint a special counsel to investigate allegations of fraud in the presidential election. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. has over the past year intensified measures that have fueled insecurity in West Asia. That's according to the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Ali Shamkhani said the height of those actions was when the U.S. assassinated top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas. Shamkhani said both were leading anti-terror figures. He said that Iran is determined to take revenge on those behind the crime. Shamkhani said Iran seeks to stop the U.S. terror and counter-security acts in the region and force it to leave. The Iranian official made the comments in a meeting with his Afghan counterpart in Tehran. Hamdullah Mohib said that Taliban militants have stepped up attacks in Afghanistan despite a peace deal that they have signed with the U.S. Mustafa Khoshesh, journalist and commentator, joins us. At the heart of Ali Shamkhani has said is the fact that the presence of U.S. forces and some of their actions, one of the worst being the assassination of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, has fueled insecurity and instability in the region, and the only solution really is for the U.S. to leave. Do you think if that happens, or when that happens, that that will indeed calm the region down?
Allah, thanks for having me. Well, I don't see any reason why. Of course, the United States bullying and its foreign policy doesn't show us a very promising path, but they want to complete their hegemonic rule over this region in order to rush to East Asia to start a tough combat and confrontation against the Chinese as their main economic rival in the next decade. But ever since the U.S. has been deployed in this region several decades ago when they started their CENTCOM in this region, they have started insecurity, and they've been a major factor contributing to regional tensions among the regional nations and regional instability, especially after, as Pentagon documents show, they intended to enforce regime change in seven nations, including Iran, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Sudan, and Somalia in 5 years. And they could do a lot to all these other nations through direct combat and invasion, or their proxy forces and their allies, European allies, and proxy forces such as the ISIL and Al-Qaeda, as documents have revealed. And as they've made confessions, I mean, in Washington, former and present officials have made many comments and many confessions showing that they've been involved in this, rise of militants in this region. But they failed in Iran, and they intensified their efforts in order to combat Iran's regional power, to contain Iran's power, and also to undermine the resistance front, the regional nations that want to have their own fate and agenda in their own hands. But the United States insists on, fracturing these nations, decomposing them, as they showed their plans, their true plans, in Syria, in Iraq, and elsewhere, in Sudan. They all showed that their greater Middle East plan means decomposition of the regional nations, and they want friction and war among these nations in order to wear off their potentials and capabilities. So they still pursue their plans, but they are facing now a rising awareness among the regional nations. They have a tough job ahead. No matter what they want, these are the regional nations that would specify the fate of this region, and they would decide the fate of this region. And of course, Iran plays a key role, a pivotal role in this region. I don't see any reason why Iran should not embrace victory at the end of the road. Maybe it takes years, but eventually, as we can compare where Iran and the resistance front were and the level of their power 20 years ago, compare it with what they are now, you may understand and foresee the future in the coming 10, 20 years. And we'll see a better future in this region if the present trend of actions go ahead and the United States continues to be under the strike of the regional nations. I believe that the regional nations, at least a number of them, will intensify their combat against the United States until they expel the U.S., since they know that the United States' presence in this region would jeopardize their security, their welfare, and their future.
Thank you very much for that, Mustafa Khoshnesh, journalist and commentator. Moving on, Iran's foreign minister says the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have gravely breached their commitments under the accord. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the criticism in a tweet following a virtual meeting with foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the deal known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Zarif said that Britain, France, and Germany should share the blame with the U.S. for what he called irreparable harm to Iranians. He added that the trio have a last chance to save the pact, which he reiterated was not renegotiable. During the Monday meeting, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov demanded Washington return to the deal without any preconditions, a call also echoed by China's top diplomat.
The United States should return to the Iran nuclear deal unconditionally as soon as possible. It should also lift the sanctions against Iran, third-party entities, as well as individuals. And on this basis, Iran should fully resume its nuclear commitments.
At the end of the meeting, all the remaining parties to the JCPOA issued a statement reiterating their deep regret over the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the deal. They also once again called for preserving the agreement. They said that the U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231 that endorsed the accord remains fully in force. Outgoing U.S. Attorney General William Barr refuses to appoint a special counsel to investigate President-elect Joe Biden's son and the November 3rd presidential election.
If I thought a special counsel at this stage was the right tool and was appropriate, I would name one, but I haven't. And to this point, I have not seen a reason to appoint a special counsel, and I have no plan to do so before I leave.
Barr added that he believes the investigation on Hunter Biden's tax affairs is being handled responsibly and professionally within the Justice Department. The president-elect's son disclosed earlier this month that the attorney's office in Delaware is looking into his tax affairs. Barr, who is set to leave office this week, also said that he would not appoint any special counsel to investigate President Donald Trump's voter fraud allegations. The attorney general's successor has declined to say if he would appoint a special counsel to investigate the two issues. The U.S. senator says dozens of email accounts of the Treasury Department have been hacked in a recent wide-ranging cyber attack on government agencies. Ron Wyden says hackers broke into systems used by the department's highest-ranking officials in what appears to be a significant operation. The Democrat says the breach seems to involve theft of encryption keys from government servers. The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has accused Russia of carrying out the hack. That is while President Donald Trump has tried to minimize the impact of the attack. Contradicting Pompeo and other officials, Trump has pointed the finger at China. Both Russia and China have denied any involvement. U.S. Congress has approved the $900 billion coronavirus relief package after months of political wrangling. The Senate approved the bill hours after it was passed by the House of Representatives. President Donald Trump is expected to sign it into law. The package includes payments for millions of Americans. It also includes jobless programs and supports businesses battered by the pandemic. Democrats and Republicans were for months in a dispute over the package, mainly on how much money should be spent. The U.S. has the world's largest coronavirus outbreak. Its total confirmed cases are above 18 million, with over 319,000 deaths. The virus has surged in recent months, threatening a tentative economic recovery. Emeritus Professor of Economics at Mexico's Metropolitan Autonomous University says that the new coronavirus aid package in the U.S. does not serve people there.
It's good that they made a deal, but the deal is a really terrible deal for most American people. It involves a tremendous decline in the amount of money that will be available for American workers as compared to the previous aid bill. And it involves a much smaller amount of money and a smaller safety net for the people, for the most vulnerable people in the United States. This is a bill that is meant to be a political victory for a very centrist group of people, and they had to pay a very, very large price to the corporate sector of the United States.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news review. International alarm is growing over a new coronavirus strain detected in Britain, with dozens of nations imposing travel bans. More than 40 countries across the world have now blocked flights or travel links with the UK. That's an effort to halt the spread of the new COVID version, already causing panic in the UK. Meanwhile, Australia has become the first country to report cases of the new strain outside of Britain. Scientists say that the variant is up to 70% more transmissible. However, there is no evidence it is more deadly. Experts say that current vaccines should still be effective against it. The World Health Organization has said that new strains are a normal part of the evolution of a pandemic. Richard Sudan is our correspondent joining us from London, and we also have Jerome Hughes, a correspondent who joins us from Brussels. Welcome. So, Richard, this is obviously not very good news. I'm curious as to what the official line the government and the official health organization in the UK has said about this, because obviously there's lots of questions that surrounded this, what's called the new variant.
Yeah, we don't yet know. I think Britons are poised to, you know, receive more information from the health secretary and the prime minister. If the handling of the coronavirus so far is anything to go by, I'm really not sure how much confidence people can place on the directions and word of the government. But as you rightly say, what we do know is that this new deadly strain is more transmissible, not necessarily more deadly. And we're already seeing, you know, for example, with the trade links with the ports of Dover leading to France, we've already seen how the panic around the coronavirus has impacted us there. And it looks as though if more and more countries are going to pose bans on entering the UK and receiving people from the UK, of course, we're going to be talking about a potential economic hit, depending on how long that situation arises for. And of course, you know, we have the likelihood of a no-deal Brexit just around the corner with all of the implications of that too. So it feels very much as though Britain is almost in a kind of crisis point at the moment.
Well, Jerome Hughes, this obviously, in a sense, does jeopardize a lot of things when we take a look at how it's going to affect different sectors of each country, especially the economy. And, of course, travel is also one other issue. But tell us the preparation that is going into this, if there's any. I mean, I know it's still relatively new, the fact that this variant is out there, and how much of a constraint it's going to put out on pretty much all of Europe, perhaps.
That's right, Cave, and I think that, you know, from the European Union's perspective, I think there's a bit of bewilderment in terms of how the British side handled this latest crisis, because a lot of people are asking, why didn't they take the first steps? Instead of having more than 40 countries, you know, imposing travel restrictions, why didn't the UK government actually take the first move and actually restrict people from leaving the country? I mean, you remember how much criticism was against China and so on in terms of how it handled the situation at the start, maybe not closing off its borders, and yet suddenly, and I mean, maybe Richard would be able to shed some light on it, but from the media that I'm monitoring in the UK, you have government ministers, cabinet ministers on the various media outlets, you had Boris Johnson's press conference yesterday. Nobody seems to be asking why, you know, why the UK did not impose restrictions on people leaving the country instead of waiting to see more than 40 countries impose restrictions. And now you have a situation in Dover, in the Channel Tunnel and so on. You have so many lorry drivers, truck drivers who want to get home for the holiday period. They're from all over Europe, and they're trapped on the UK side. And I know that we're, you know, people talk, well, maybe this is tit for tat, maybe this is sour grapes from the EU side in terms of Brexit. Maybe that's not true. Maybe this is just a sort of a health response. But at the same time, you have to ask the question, you have to wonder, if the UK was still part of the EU, would we have seen this situation develop as it has done, the sort of unilateral action taken by the several countries at the start, Belgium, Italy, and France, and the Netherlands, and the sort of, you know, and this sort of hostility towards Britain. That's the feeling I get. Perhaps that hostility wouldn't have been there, it would have been more coordinated if the UK was still part of the European Union. And we now have 9 days till a transition period. What's actually compounding the problem as well is that it's not just the Christmas period where you'd have more goods coming from the EU into the UK, and then obviously the lorry drivers want to get back. But also you have a situation that, because of the transition period ending in 9 days, a lot of the businesses were stocking up. They were actually making provisions to stockpile goods. And so actually you have more lorries over there now than you would have normally. So you've got the perfect storm. You've got the COVID-19, the new strain. You've got the Christmas period. You've got the transition period and all the rest of it. But I think from the EU's perspective, they feel that this new strain does pose a big challenge, in the sense that if you look here, for example, in Belgium, I mean, 4 or 5 weeks ago, we were getting 20,000 new cases of coronavirus a day in Belgium. But because of very strict measures, a curfew starting at 10 o'clock each night, and because everything is effectively closed down, apart from shops, even hairdressers are closed down, restaurants and cafes and so on. Well, now we have today, for example, the latest figures come out this morning, we have 981 new cases. That's under 1,000 new cases. So countries like Belgium, who have done so much to try and contain the problem, they don't want a new variant coming over here and creating havoc. So you can understand from their point of view why they would impose travel bans.
Okay, and Richard Sudan, before I let you go, there are some facts that are very alarming regarding this new variant, and I don't know if it's possible for you to maybe separate the fact from fiction. One of them is the fact that this new variant is 70% more transmissible. Is that actually accurate? And of course, then comes the fact that, as Jerome, I think, somewhat alluded to, that is that there needs to be lots of precautions taken at this point in order for this not to spread the way that it could. Is the UK taking those precautionary measures? Is the seriousness of and the gravity of the situation being felt by 10 Downing Street?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, you know, the ordinary people here are not privy to any kind of special information. It does certainly seem, though, according to all the kind of public health and health experts in general, certainly this is more likely to be transmitted, and therefore it brings us back to the central question, really, in terms of things like the health service, in terms of those who are more likely to be impacted and are especially vulnerable. What provisions and safeguards have been put in place for the people fighting the virus on the front line, and of course those most susceptible? And I'm afraid, really, for most people, the answer to that question is that the government has been wholly woeful and inadequate, really, from the get-go. And I don't really see that changing necessarily because of a new strain. You know, one would hope this would kickstart the government into a kind of action plan that's going to prevent more needless deaths. You know, let's wait and see.
Thank you for that, Richard Sudan, correspondent there from London. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent there from Brussels. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in. And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The vo- Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Gunrunners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Coffey, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gunrunners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, who are also known as warriors, Julius Orile and Robert Mutanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Orile enter international marathons, while Mutanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though, as we see these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime, and we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, is quite commonplace because that's an important source of income, and this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya is a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously it gives a great film title then, Gunrunners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks. You know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film that would I would have maybe, you know, it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gunrunners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I go, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context. So that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. These little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing. I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes.
Which is absolutely breathtaking.
Exquisite. In Kenya, over to the skyscrapers of New York. You could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes. Really is very much the superstar, the very talented runner and so on. And his mate, Matanda, seems to be much more the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
Valiv, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons there. But, you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me, it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
This Saturday marks the first annual Tekla Lorupe Peace Race. Tekla Lorupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Arile and Matanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve, they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really, and can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Matanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500 effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. So this guy's a people organizer. Of course, he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate. And he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Arile, on the other hand, is the rising star, the the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid he was winning things at kind of at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. One of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was, he said, well, the skills I need to run, I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in a marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand with their ability to be good athletes. And Lee, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Mutanda he's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underline is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country. It's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously mm-hmm. helping that situation.
When I was in the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find the difficult when I started to run, because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you, and then you'll be in a hot soup.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Mutanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Relay. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Matanda's character compared to Relay's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different, so you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, you know, described it very well. Matanda's the sort of more social, you know, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, you know, draw people in. Relay is much more kind of, you know, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, you know, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways, and I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Mutanda pursue politics, but then of course we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here. But it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, you know, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. But what it says to me is that these individual talents kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever, And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, you know, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out from in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that is that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflict. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people. And so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. But of course, you know, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
Dream about my future. Mostly I dream about money. I will build this, I will build that, many things like that.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete and I can run a marathon.
He really does need to make a breakthrough. And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race starting at Prague's Old Town Square in this historic city.
So really is very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of a journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it and stuff. So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages. And actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting. But I'm more interested in the sort of the world that shapes their, you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, are you agreeing with Lieber?
Absolutely, the journey's fascinating. And none of these characters are pristine. Arile got somebody pregnant when she was quite young. It led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. But later on, he's now got three wives. And children by all of them. So if he's not able to put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught. And actually the story, as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after, and an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on.
I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Arile's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have, you know, appreciated a bit more. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Tete, isn't it quite sad, though, that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation, and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. He might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. So it's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting, because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletics industry, is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
Sure. It's incredibly corrupt. So it's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way in a not-so-easy world.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermons and letters and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And of course, we are discussing about the qualities of the pious people, and we are in a way trying to count the different types of flowers that exist in the garden of the heart of one who is pious. Different and beautiful flowers of different kinds. And we saw, you know, the fear of God, humility, kindness to others, crying in the middle of the night, praying to God, and all of those wonderful qualities. One of those very powerful and one of the most beautiful qualities of one who is pious is the quality of contentment, al-qana'ah. So as it goes by the phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam says in the sermon, qani'atan nafsuh, that a pious person is one whose soul, whose nafs is content. And of course, we discussed about the meaning of contentment and the meaning of greed in the Holy Quran, which is the opposite of contentment. And in the previous session, we talked about the issue that being content is having that beautiful life that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Holy Quran, لَنُحْيِيَنَّهُ حَيَاةً طَيِّبًا, that He will give him a good life. That good life is that life of contentment.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, building up to what was said in the previous segment, that a content life is that good life of spirituality, that life of that is full, that is blissful, that is blossoming in all its dimensions. That beautiful life is the one of contentment. So our fourth Imam, Imam Ali Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam, says in Dua Abu Hamza Thumali reportedly that regarding the issue of a wonderful life, he says that وَاجْعَلْنِي مِمَّنْ أَطَلْتَ عُمْرَهُ وَحَسَّنْتَ عَمَلَهُ وَأَتْمَمْتَ عَلَيْهِ نِعْمَتَكَ وَرَضِيتَ عَنْهُ وَأَحْيَيْتَهُ حَيَاةً طَيِّبَةً. That, O Allah, include me amongst those who you have increased their lifespan, who you have beautified their actions, and whom you have completed your blessings upon them, and upon whom you are pleased, and upon whom that you have given the beautiful life. Those who have who you have enlivened them with the beautiful and good life. في أدوم السرور وأسبغ الكرامة وأتم العيش. The one who has this beautiful life is how, then he explains, with continuous bliss and happiness. وأسبغ الكرامة, with continuous and profuse nobility. وأتم العيش, and the complete form of life. إنك تفعل ما تشاء, you are the one who does what you want. Of course, you have the full control of your actions. ولا يفعل ما يشاء غيرك, but the other people are not in full control of their actions. Anyways, this particular dua teaches us what is this life of contentment. In summary, it teaches us that yes, in the if you being having a content life doesn't mean that you don't ask for good things in the spiritual sense. Rather, there are wonderful spiritual blessings with the, as a result of being content. And of course, inshallah, as we are approaching towards the end of this segment, we are going to slowly build up, and I'm going to talk about some of the intricacies that are mentioned in this section of the dua.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, as I mentioned previously, this dua is teaching us about what a content life is, because the word we are asking Allah that, oh Allah, make me amongst that one who you have given a beautiful life. And Imam Ali alayhi salam translated it and interpreted that beautiful good life as contentment, a life of contentment. A life of contentment is of course this type of life where a person, Imam Ali alayhi salam, Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, explains with always with continuous happiness and nobility and complete fulfillment in life. This is the way a good life is, and this is only when a person is content materially and he's pleased within himself with whatever Allah has decided. Of course, in the start he says, make me one of those who you have increased their lifespan. Again, a question that might come here is is this against contentment? That means we should be happy with a short life. Instead, why are we asking for a long life here? As I mentioned previously, contentment is not against seeking more of spiritual perfections. When we are asking, oh Allah, give me a long life, we are also explaining what type of life we want. We want a life of obedience. We want a life of true perfections. That's the type of life. But otherwise, in other verses of the Quran, in other du'as we have, when Imam Ali alayhi salam says, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, in one of the du'as says that, oh Allah, if you see that my life is becoming a grazing ground for the devil, then take away my life. I don't want this type of life. I am content with the little life that you've given me, with obedience rather than a long life of disobedience. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He gives us the opportunity to beautify our life, to make our hearts in such a way that they are able to experience this wonderful life that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is talking about in this verse, and also which Imam Ali alayhi salam is referring to in this narration. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio.
with you every single moment.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.